ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Hello, and welcome to ID, the Future. I'm Emily Reeves, and today I'm talking to my friend, colleague, and coworker, Casey Luskin. Welcome, Casey.
Thanks, Emily. It's great to be on the show with you.
I remember, Casey, the first time that I met you. I guess it's been almost 10 years ago now. And I was just so impressed by your enthusiasm and contagious passion for intelligent design. I just want to say for any listeners not familiar with Casey, just to give you a little background about him, he has been a longstanding proponent of intelligent design and really a key figure in this movement. Now today, we're going to be talking about one of Casey's other passions that overlaps with ID in some ways, but it's a little bit different, and that would be geology, or more specifically, paleomagnetism. So I don't know, Casey, would you like to just tell our listeners about how your involvement with ID overlaps with your excitement about geology?
Thank you so much, Emily, for that extremely kind introduction. And I think someday we'll have to reverse the roles and I will have to interview you about your passion and excitement for intelligent design, because I certainly appreciate that very much as well. But for me, the beginning at least, there was not a lot of overlap between ID and geology. In fact, it was like these elective courses that I was taking during my undergraduate geology degree that had nothing to do with geology that got me interested in evolution and intelligent design, as oddly as that may sound. When I was an undergraduate at UC San Diego, you know, obviously you had to take your core major courses. Those were all geology courses, but then I could take elective courses. And for me, almost every elective course that I had the opportunity to take, I would take in evolutionary biology. And that is what actually got me very interested in the topic of evolution and origins. It was only later that I realized, you know what, this topic of intelligent design can actually say some things about geology and vice versa. Maybe I started to appreciate that a little bit more during my PhD. I think we'll talk about that a little bit more during the course of this podcast, but there's definitely overlap between the two. And I think that one of my goals in the very long term, hopefully, will be to explore some of those connections over the coming years.
I find that very fascinating that you had two kind of separate interests and passion for both, yet you've been able to now see different aspects of that overlap. So Casey, you received your PhD from the University of Johannesburg in paleomagnetism in 2020. First off, congrats for completing that. And second, doing it in 2020. Wow. Getting a PhD is hard enough, but doing it in 2020 deserves a second round of applause. So probably you have many stories about that.
Yeah, that's certainly true, Emily. And I know you've heard some of these stories before. I won't bore the listeners too much with them, but basically I finished writing my PhD thesis literally the same week that the coronavirus hit South Africa. And my wife and I were told by the US State Department and everybody else that we knew that if we didn't get out of South Africa immediately, we could be stranded indefinitely. And so we had to pack up and sell or give away everything we owned, literally, including our cat, sadly, and leave the country on about 5 to 10 days notice in the middle of March of 2020. We caught just about the last flight out of South Africa back into the US before they shut down all international air traffic. It was definitely one of the craziest times of our lives. Thank God we did get back to the US right at the beginning of the lockdown. And we ended up then getting stranded in Southern California, where we lived as nomads with family for about 4 months. When we first arrived, we had no car, we had no cell phones. We didn't even have a Costco card, you know, so we weren't even like real Americans. And we had to sort of rebuild our lives in the early months of the lockdown in 2020, which was a challenge. But on the other hand, it was definitely a blessing to us because we obviously had not seen our families a lot over the previous 4 to 5 years. And we got to spend a lot of time with them because we had nowhere else to go other than sleeping in their guest bedrooms. And it was an interesting time, one that was very, I think, defining for us, but also one that we will never forget.
That sounds like a true adventure and a true 2020 story.
Well, you know, I like to say when I tell the story that I recognize that everybody had a chaotic 2020. I don't want to play my violin too much because, I mean, everybody had a rough year in 2020. It certainly was not just us.
I mean, a lot of people lost loved ones, and we certainly have a lot to be thankful for, having still our good health.
But this is my story. It's what it is. It was pretty crazy, but we got through it, and I'm very thankful for that.
What got you interested into geology in the first place? I know you've shared a little bit with me before that you, even as a child, found rocks fascinating and like what types of rocks and what got you excited about them in the first place.
Yeah, so I was one of those weird kids who was always into rocks. I remember we'd go on family vacations in my parents' RV throughout the American Southwest. And I would ask my dad to pull over the motorhome in the middle of the desert so I could go run off in the middle of nowhere and just look at rocks. So I was just that weird kid who collected rocks. I don't know why. It's always been like that. I was always interested in what we call igneous rocks. Igneous rocks are rocks that initially at least form as volcanic or magmatic in some form. They may come out of a volcano or they may intrude into the earth at some depth and then cool. There's a lot of different types of igneous rocks. Part of it might have been my family took some trips to Hawaii when I was a kid, and we would go there and see the volcanoes and the amazing lava flows, and that always interested me.
I know very little about geology, so maybe what are those different parts of geology, and of those, which is your favorite part, or where did you focus during your PhD studies?
Once I got into university and I learned about plate tectonics, that immediately became my favorite part of geology. I thought that plate tectonics, I still do feel this way, is an extremely well-supported theory that ties together so many different geological observations, like why do earthquakes happen in certain areas? Why are there volcanoes in certain areas? Why are there mountain ranges in certain parts of the world? I think there's a lot of evidence backing plate tectonics, such as you can match up fossils on opposite sides of oceans when you sort of bring the continents back together and those fossils match up, or rock types. So the seafloor is magnetized. When it cools at a mid-ocean ridge, the molten rock that comes out gets magnetized by the Earth's magnetic field. And depending upon how the magnetic field is oriented, when lava gets extruded at a mid-ocean ridge, you can actually see what we call magnetic stripes in the seafloor by measuring the magnetization of the seafloor. And when you understand the patterns of these magnetic stripes, you can literally visually see how the seafloors spread, how the continents have broken up and spread apart, how the oceans have widened, and how continents have moved over time. And you can rewind the tape and fit the continents back together. And I just felt like, I still do feel this way, that the evidence for plate tectonics is incredibly powerful and incredibly strong. So for me, I think also talked about what got me interested in geology. Growing up in Southern California, where we had a lot of earthquakes, that definitely got me interested in it. But plate tectonics helped explain, well, why are there earthquakes in Southern California? And why was I constantly being awakened in the middle of the night growing up as a kid?
Wow, plate tectonics does sound like a fascinating field. Would you be able to share any of your favorite resources with people if they'd like to learn more about plate tectonics?
Yeah, I mean, Emily, a lot of the concepts I just talked about, I understand that it's hard to explain this if you're not having visuals or diagrams. So you can Google any of the terms that I talked about and come up with some nice diagrams. Mid-ocean ridges, magnetic stripes, seafloor spreading. Those are all great search terms, and you'll immediately get some great images on Google to get an idea of what I'm talking about. There's also US Geological Survey has a great website explaining plate tectonics. It's called The Dynamic Earth, The Story of Plate Tectonics. It's a really nice sort of online book you can read. It's a very useful resource.
Well, thank you for sharing those. Now, I'd like to bring this conversation back around intelligent design. And would you describe your PhD research as being related to intelligent design? And if so, did that play into why you chose geology, or you just decided to pursue this other passion for a period of time?
The short answer to your question is probably no, Emily. My research in my PhD was not really related to intelligent design. I had done my master's degree in paleomagnetism, and it's a subject I find really interesting because paleomagnetism is one of the primary tools we use for understanding plate tectonics and understanding how and where continents have moved in the past. And so my PhD research was also in paleomagnetism. It just played into that fascination with plate tectonics. So I guess for me, I do have interests outside of intelligent design. That being said, I do think that there could be some potential intelligent design implications from the design of the Earth. These are arguments I'm still thinking about and developing, but I think there are some potential ID connections here when we talk about plate tectonics and how the Earth works.
Connecting your passion in geology and your interest in ID at a recent insider's briefing, you did comment on how geology does provide evidence for intelligent design. And that really intrigued me. You know, I'm a biochemist, and I'm familiar with the arguments for design in biology, but really not at all in geology. So I'm wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about what were some of the lines of evidence for design and geology.
During the Insiders Briefing Conference we had in the summer of 2021, I gave a little talk that gave three special life-friendly properties of Earth. And I think that we can make an argument for design from these, but at least for now, I can say that these are special properties of Earth. We're not aware of other planets that have these properties, at least all in one place, you could say, to have all three of these together. And one would be for Earth to be a rocky planet with a strong magnetic field. And the geomagnetic field is important because it protects life on Earth from harmful radiation. And it also protects the atmosphere from being stripped away by the solar wind. Plate tectonics, then, of course, is another special property of Earth that we are not aware of any other planet in our solar system or anywhere else that has plate tectonics. And plate tectonics is important for recycling vital elements that living organisms need. So, for example, when a shelled organism like plankton forms a shell made of calcium carbonate, and then it dies, and then it falls down through the water column and gets buried in the sediment at the bottom of the ocean. Over time, this depletes the ocean of vital nutrients like calcium, phosphorus, carbon, sulfur, nitrogen. As plate tectonics happens, the ocean crust gets subducted down, where all of these elements and materials that are in the sediment of the ocean crust, they melt and they come back up out through volcanoes to the Earth's surface, where they then are either released into the atmosphere or they come out actually as lava that is extruded at volcanoes. And eventually they erode or find their way back into the oceans again. So Earth literally has a recycling program where life necessary nutrients are taken down into the deep Earth after they fall out of the ocean. They're subducted down, they come back up out volcanoes. They then are extruded to the Earth's surface or the atmosphere, and they make their way back into the oceans again where organisms can use them. And this process goes on over and over again.
Wow, I had no idea that plate tectonics was actually involved in recycling. That seems to have many design implications.
Yeah, and I'll just say another property I mentioned in this talk is just the fact that Earth has water. And I know that a lot of people are familiar with the argument that we have to have a very special location in our solar system for the Earth to have liquid water. That is obviously a design parameter of the Earth. But what about just the fact that Earth has water to begin with? It turns out that it's very difficult to explain how a planet this close to the sun could have been able to collect so much water when the solar system formed 4.5 billion years ago. And it's still sort of a mystery for planetary geologists why Earth has so much water for a planet this close to the sun.
I know, Casey, that in your writings on intelligent design, you often talk about it being a historical science. I'm curious if your geological training and your PhD studies have influenced at all now the way that you frame intelligent design.
I would definitely like to think so, Emily, and I appreciate that question very much. So geology obviously is a historical science, and in geology, we're always trying to study past events. And the way we do that is we use what we call the principle of uniformitarianism. We study causes that are in effect in the world around us today. We can see a stream that erodes the stream bed. We can see a volcano that is extruding lava and that is building up the volcano over time. Or we can see various other processes that are at work in the Earth around us today. And then we can extrapolate and say, okay, well, if these causes that we can observe today were at work in the past, then what would they do? And how can we use these causes to then explain the historical record? And so what we do in geology is we study these causes in the present day. We learn to identify their known effects. And then we look at the historical record to find the known effects of these causes. And when we find those known effects, we can infer that those causes were at work. So for example, we observe, this is very basic, that when a volcano explodes, it releases a huge ash cloud into the atmosphere. And that ash then falls down to the ground and leaves an ash layer on the ground. Okay, so we observe that volcanoes leave ash layers. Very, very basic observation. What happens then when we're looking at geological layers and we find a very thin layer of ash? Well, that could be good evidence that a volcano nearby had gone off. And so we can use that same kind of reasoning to explain the historical record. Well, ID works in very much the same way. ID uses the principle of uniformitarianism in that we ask, what are the kinds of products that are produced when an intelligent agent is at work? We can observe human intelligent agents and ask, what kinds of things do intelligent agents produce. And we find that intelligent agents produce high levels of complex and specified information, often in the form of language or codes or language-based codes. And so lo and behold, what do we find in living organisms? We find that at the very heart of life is a language-based code in our DNA. We find computer-like information processing. We find molecular machines in life. But in all of our experience with these things, based upon how things work in the world around us today, these sorts of things, language-based code, computer-like information property, machine-like structures, in our experience with the world around us today, these things always come from an intelligent cause or an intelligent source. When we can trace back to their actual origin, they always come from an intelligent cause. And so we can use this principle of uniformitarianism in a very similar manner to detect design in the historical record. I've always seen a connection between intelligent design and geology in that they use parallel forms of reasoning to make inferences to certain causes that were at work in the past.
So this is basically the idea, right, that the present can, through using the scientific method to test the way things are working now, can give us information potentially about the way things worked in the past. And we can use that to frame different models and thinking about origins. And
absolutely. Yes, that's exactly right.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Now, my husband and I have been over to your house to visit with you guys. And we have noticed that you have these really beautiful pictures on the walls. They have incredible patterns and designs. And I think they are of rocks. Can you tell us a little bit about those photos? And is there any connection with them to design?
Yes. So again, this is very difficult to talk about without a visuals, but I'll try to describe this. During my PhD, and I think this is sort of rite of passage for most geology PhD students, is when you collect a rock sample, among all the other analyses you do, you always take it to the thin section lab. They make a microscope slide out of your rock, basically making a very thin cut through the rock where you can actually look at it in a thin section on a microscope. And then you use that to determine what minerals are in the rock. And it can give you a lot of information about what kind of a rock is it, how the rock formed, what was the environment in which the rock formed. You can learn a lot from doing petrography, studying thin sections of rocks. And so I did analyses of every one of the, 100 or so sites that I collected samples in my PhD of these rock thin sections. But what I began to discover is, Emily, is that these things are beautiful and they literally look like stained glass windows. You know, you could take the most mundane rock that you find on the street, or you're walking down a dirt road, kicking a rock along, pick it up, turn it into a microscope slide, and you can look at it under plain light or cross polarized light. And you will just see beautiful colors come to life. Wow. And incredible patterns and incredible shapes and detail like you wouldn't believe that makes some of our Wow. most beautiful stained glass windows that humans have created. They will look like little doodle sketches compared to these things. This is sort of an aesthetic argument for design. It's not a formal, rigorous one. But I just feel like God has a 24/7 tour of stained glass windows all day, every day, in what we would consider to be the most boring rocks on the planet. And I hope over time to maybe be able to share some of these photos. I've had a lot of friends tell me, Casey, you need to sell these because they're so beautiful. I mean, people want to put these on their walls. And I agree, they are beautiful. I don't know if I can make money off them because they're research that I did in my PhD, but maybe I can at least share these with people for free. It's an argument for design that people ought to know about from an aesthetic standpoint. Rock thin sections. And again, maybe this is just me being a rock weirdo, but I think they're beautiful. And I've had a lot of people who are not rock weirdos say the same thing, that they also think that they look like beautiful stained glass windows. If somebody ever comes to my office, you'll see these photographs. I have them all over my office and they're really cool.
Yeah, I think they're so striking. And I encourage, if you visit Casey's office, be sure to check out these amazing photographs that he has captured from his PhD research. It's kind of a fun way of also remembering that time period too, I suspect.
For sure. And again, like we said earlier about, you can Google this stuff since it's hard to describe in audio. Just Google rock thin section or rock microscope slide, and you will see exactly what I'm talking about instantly. They're really quite incredible.
So what does the future hold for your overlapping interests between geology and ID? Do you plan on developing these ideas further or writing a book someday?
Yeah, you know, Emily, I think that Michael Denton's book, The Wonder of Water, which I'm sure many of our listeners have read, does a great job of summarizing and developing some arguments that have an overlap between design and geology. Other people provide a nice summary of geological arguments for fine-tuning of the Earth or even design. Those are books like Rare Earth or Lucky Planet or The Privileged Planet, which obviously the latter is an explicit ID-friendly book by Guillermo Gonzalez and Jay Richards. So I do think there's room to further develop geological arguments for design and fine tuning. And I do hope to do that down the road. Right now, I'm focusing on some other projects and some papers I'm writing. And at the moment, I'm just insanely busy, frankly, trying to help manage all of our research projects in the ID 3.0 research program. It's a lot of fun, but it's difficult to keep up with the steady stream of scientists who want to join the ID research community. I think if our listeners and supporters appreciated just how frequently we are dialoguing with new scientists that want to join the ranks of the ID community, they would be highly encouraged. So as for a book someday, we'll just have to see. It sounds great. And I'd love to put that on my bucket list of things to do. But because you never know what the future holds, I don't want to commit anything like that just yet. But it's definitely on my bucket list to write a solid book on the intersection of geological arguments and intelligent design and see where that goes. So we'll just have to see what the future holds, Emily.
I would definitely buy that book. And I'm sure many of our listeners would as well. It's always really fun hearing how those ideas intersect.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, Emily. And one of the things that I love about the ID community is that, yes, we've got plenty of biologists, biochemists, physicists, and that's very important because those are where I think the core arguments for intelligent design exist. But we have a lot of other arguments for design in other fields. And we have so many people with so many different backgrounds in various scientific fields in the ID community. And I think that over time, we're going to see ID expanding into these other fields. So I'm excited to see where it goes in the future.
Well, Casey, it has been wonderful talking with you today and hearing how geology and ID intersect for you. We look forward to any other overlap that you continue to do on geology and design. So be sure to keep us updated.
Thank you so much, Emily.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.